I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. On Sunday, Sprint executives announced plans to merge with T-Mobile. While the deal has yet to be approved, officials plan to move the company's headquarters from Overland Park to Bellevue, Washington. So what could these changes mean for Kansas City? Today, we'll take a look at the obstacles ahead for the merger and the ways in which Sprint has impacted the local community. Then, before cell phones and even telegraphs, national news was delivered on horseback. We sit down with one historian to learn how, in just 18 months, the Pony Express became a pivotal part of American culture. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The news that T-Mobile and Sprint would like to merge has rocked the telecommunications industry, not to mention the Kansas City area, which could see significant job losses. Now a conversation about what this merger, if approved, could mean for the metro and what Sprint's impact on the region has been for all these years. Here's a hint. It's been pretty darn significant. We begin with a look at the legal and policy aspects of this proposed $32 billion merger. With us now, Philip Barenbrock joins us on the phone from Washington. He's a senior policy counsel for Public Knowledge. That's a group that works for an open internet and access to affordable communications. Philip, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's cut right to the quick here. How would you handicap whether the federal government will wind up actually approving this merger or not?
You know, it's going to be tough. You know, this is a merger in a marketplace that under the guidelines the Department of Justice uses to look at market concentration. It's an already highly concentrated marketplace. This merger would take four national competitors, reduce it down to three, so further concentrating that market, likely having harmful impacts on competition and higher prices on consumers. And the really important piece here is the two merging companies here. You have the number four player, who is Sprint, the number three player is T-Mobile. They're sort of the two innovative, maverick-type competitors in the space. And they're sort of the scrappy underdog struggling to keep up with Verizon and AT&T. But combined, they'll look a lot like Verizon and AT&T. So they'll have a lot less incentive to continue their sort of scrappy pro consumer pricing plans and service innovation. So I don't want to necessarily handicap it, but Wall Street is not doesn't appear to be that impressed by the odds.
You mentioned higher prices, like they might be a foregone conclusion, Philip, if this merger goes through. Do you see it that way?
Things can surprise you, but typically, what you see is when consumers have fewer choices and the players in a marketplace sort of look the same and have the same incentives in the marketplace, there's just going to be, less incentives to compete on price. T-Mobile and Sprint over the last 4 or 5 years have been engaged in a price war that's really helped them keep and, in T-Mobile's case, improve its market share. Mm-hmm. And it's created a lot of really great pro-consumer innovations. We've seen, the elimination of the mandatory two-year service contract. T-Mobile got rid of below-the-line fees that mm-hmm. consumers hate. T-Mobile went with all unlimited plans, and Sprint, followed suit pretty quickly thereafter. And it even made AT&T and Verizon start dropping prices and discounting, which they'd been loath to do. So, without the incentives to really gain market share through price competition, which, this merger will probably reduce those incentives, we're likely to see less of that and as a result, probably higher prices.
So even consumers of AT&T and Verizon, they could see higher prices too. Does that go without saying here?
Yeah. I mean, so... Mm-hmm. If you were in the wireless market for the last 4 or 5 years, it was a great time to be a consumer because prices were falling, the networks were getting faster, and you had choices, and you had T-Mobile and Sprint, which were essentially, competing to lower prices and give you a better service plan. So even if you were a T-Mobile even if you were an AT&T or Verizon customer, you might have seen the opportunity to switch to a lower priced plan that your provider might not have otherwise offered. So yeah, customers of all of the wireless providers are likely to see, less innovative services and higher prices across the board.
So how big a factor then is the impact on the consumer, given the range of issues that the SEC and the Justice Department will consider here? How big of a deal is the impact on the consumer?
So it's a big deal. So the Department of Justice is going to look at competition in the marketplace. One of the impacts of reducing competition is usually harm on consumers. In this case, through higher prices or potentially less innovative service plans. The FCC has an even broader mandate than just looking at competition. They also look at whether the deal will serve the public interest. There's a whole range of issues they can look at that is broader than just the DOJ's narrow competition analysis. The impact on consumers should be at the forefront of the FCC's merger analysis.
What else will the FCC look at here? What are the other big factors?
So other big factors are going to be things like, are there enough companies in the marketplace that have access to enough of the wireless spectrum, the sort of the frequencies, the secret sauce that make wireless service possible? Are there players in the market who have enough of that spectrum? If T-Mobile and Sprint consolidate, does it give them too much spectrum? Issues like that. Issues like pricing. It's sort of the public interest standard can be broad or narrow depending on the FCC that or the leadership of the FCC that's doing the merger analysis. But unfortunately, what we've sort of seen in the last year and a half is this FCC has sort of taken a more narrow view of what the public interest is. So, this should really be an acid test for how it's going to look at competition and consumer welfare in the wireless market going forward.
So, bottom line is, Philip, you're not bullish on the fact that you think this merger will ultimately be approved. You think it could be rejected?
I think there's a strong chance it could be rejected. I think, most of the legal analysis that you see out there, most of the analysis from Wall Street is somewhat skeptical. It's why, on Monday, the day after the merger was announced, typically when you have a merger announced like this, the share prices for the companies tend to go up. In this case, the share prices for the two companies went down. I think that reflected some skepticism in the market that regulators will eventually sign off. And frankly, I think, the recent history of mergers in the wireless marketplace is working against them. These two companies talked about merging in 2014, and the Department of Justice and FCC sort of, convinced them not to move forward. AT&T and T-Mobile tried to merge in 2011, and the Justice Department sued to block it. So, anything's possible, I guess, but I wouldn't necessarily bet on it.
Final point, the companies are trying to market this merger as this big job creation opportunity. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's it's clever, and they also make some claims about 5G and competition with China for 5G. And I think when your listeners hear those claims, what they should really hear is that there aren't any legal arguments that support their merger. So they're really relying on these ephemeral claims that are really difficult to prove. In most mergers, the big benefit that the merging parties tout to Wall Street is the ability to eliminate redundancies, eliminate overhead, get rid of redundant employees, things like that. It's unlikely that you've got, a horizontal merger that actually adds headcount. So, I'm skeptical of this claim.
Okay, that's Philip Behrenbrock. He's Senior Policy Counsel for Public Knowledge. Philip, thanks a lot for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's turn to the impact on Kansas City here. And joining us now as we talk about this proposed merger between Sprint and T-Mobile, Mark Davis. He's covered Sprint for years for the Kansas City Star. Mark, welcome back.
Good morning.
Frank Lenk is a director of research services for the Mid-America Regional Council, also known as MARC. Frank, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Frank, you're a big picture guy. Potentially, how significant a moment is this for the Kansas City area? What's been Sprint's impact on the region for all these years if this merger goes through?
So the impact has been tremendous. You know, sort of as Sprint goes, so has gone the region. During the 1990s, it grew very fast, and the region grew faster than the U.S. average. During the 2000s, it shrunk, and the region as a whole grew slower than the U.S. average. And, you know, every job at Sprint has a multiplier effect. Every job we gain or lose adds at least another job someplace else in the economy. Mm-hmm. So, but we've been doing this for 17 years, really. We've lost about 17—Sprint has lost about 17,000 jobs over that period. So they're averaging, you know, 1,000 job loss per year over that period. And, you know, we've weathered that, and you could say we've weathered the bulk of whatever disasters might be in the offing. And I don't think they're going to close the headquarters here. Mm-hmm. There's likely to remain employment here. It's a question of the kind of employment that's here and how well paid it is, and whether there's, you know, the extent of the job loss. I kind of agree with the prior caller that it's unlikely for a merger like this not to result in some job loss, at least temporarily. If it really does set the stage for future growth, then that's great. That's why you invest in things like 5G. But those are claims yet to be proven.
You know, Mark Davis, again, with the Star, you see these different numbers these days for how many Sprint employees there are in Overland Park. What's the best number you've got?
Well, the last number we got from them was about 6,000. Now, since that number, they've announced they're cutting out 500 jobs, and that's in the Overland Park campus headquarters.
Yeah.
So compare that to the numbers Frank was talking about, you know, in the 90s. This company had 23,000 employees around here.
23,000.
Now we're down to 6. And even that number is shrinking because they're laying people off. You know, one of the questions I was asking the companies in this merger is, can you tell people at the Overland Park campus their jobs are secure with this merger? Well, the reality is they're not secure now.
Mm-hmm. And they can't guarantee anything right now.
They say we're going to grow from day one jobs, but John Ledger, the CEO of T-Mobile, was, I think, candid in saying, I don't know how to say that your job is secure there. They're going to look for duplication. They will find it. And the employees that are at that campus in Overland Park essentially are auditioning for a post-merger job right now.
Yeah. You know, Frank, you've said that Sprint has continued to be a major player in the metro. How so? Because like a lot of things, I think a lot of people just took Sprint for granted after a while.
Well, it is a huge importer of dollars from outside the country. Where do they sell their phones? They sell some here, but they sell the bulk of them out of the region.
So and money that, comes
that's
in.
What that's yeah. what creates economic impact. That's why regions grow, as if they're serving the larger economy. You can't grow by taking each other's laundry. You can only grow by serving a larger market. So Sprint is one of those companies that does that. It's highly productive. So the output per employee at a telecom company is huge, which means that their salaries can be higher than average as well. And so they're well-paid workers, bringing dollars in more so than most companies. And so they have an outsized economic impact on the region.
Tell us about the importance of patents and Sprint, because Sprint has had a lot of them.
Yeah, I think that's one of the areas that's less clear. They have a lot of patents. We would get more economic bang if they'd share some of those patents and create new firms with those patents. It's not clear that a lot of that has happened. Maybe some of it, but it's harder to track. It's harder for me to track.
Yeah.
But that intellectual property is part of what makes them attractive to buy. Mm-hmm. You know, they have assets. They have spectrum. They have intellectual property. And they have networks, and so those all make them attractive to buy. I will say, we have to also consider what is the alternative for if Sprint were to go on its own. Is it a viable company in the long run? Maybe this is the best of a bad hand that we've been dealt. Maybe this is the best outcome possible, is to be bought and have the chance for growth than in the future.
Mark Davis, can Sprint make it on its own if this merger doesn't go through, as our analyst suggested it might not?
You know, that's a great question that nobody really can answer until we get there. But the problem Sprint faces is one of scale. AT&T and Verizon have, you know, roughly 100 million customers that they can bill to pay for all the things they have to do to their network to keep that up, to advertise, to market, all that kind of stuff. Sprint has 54 million. And they owe a lot of money to a lot of people. They have a heavy debt burden. And the question is, how do you finance a business that needs to put $6 billion into its network in the next 12 months? And that's what Sprint says they need to do. Mm-hmm. And they already, they're borrowing money continually. They just announced more debt that they're borrowing against their Airwave licenses. They went back to the high yield bond market and borrowed more money there. It's going to take billions of dollars for this company to stay in the game. And that's just not working out so far, which is why we're still seeing layoffs, why we're still seeing them struggle.
Frank?
Yeah, so what Sprint has always had is a surplus of spectrum, and they've been banking on that surplus to allow them to expand in ways that other carriers could not and offer higher quality. But if you don't have the capital to invest in utilizing that spectrum, then it just sits there as a resource that's unused.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where they are.
Well, that's been the promise of Sprint. You could go back to Dan Hesse's days. We're going to build a network to leapfrog the competition. We've got the spectrum. We can do this. That's made even more true now as we're going to 5G. The stuff Sprint has is particularly good for 5G. It's not the best stuff that for 4G, the LTE that we have now, but it is really good for the 5G technology that's coming.
Is that where Sprint's going? Is
well,
that where
if they can find the money to do it, that's where they're spending the $6 billion. That's where everybody's going is 5G. And they probably have the assets to do that, which is the thing they're bringing to T-Mobile. T-Mobile has assets, but this spectrum that Sprint's been promising to deploy for a very long time is really good stuff now. It's the prime thing.
And Mark, 5G, just so everyone's on the same page here, is even faster service. I mean, what is 5G?
It's the same thing that you're doing with your phone now, but at a capacity and a speed and a quick response that you can do things like connected cars. You can do remote surgeries, this kind of stuff. It's not just faster. It's got other qualities and capacities that you as a consumer on your phone are really not going to notice, but you're going to have the Internet of Things possible. Mm-hmm. It's the highway for a lot of new technology. Companies we haven't even heard of yet will be born when 5G becomes available.
Frank Lang?
We've gone from 3G to 4G, and the big innovation was streaming movies. So now going from 4G to 5G allows that similar ramp up and whole new capacities that we don't even know exactly how we're going to use them yet, but mm-hmm. but that's the quantum sort of leap in speed and capacity that we'll get out of 5G.
We're talking about the future of Sprint as these merger talks go forward here. Mark, you can't help but wonder about what happens to the Overland Park campus if the merger goes through, if it doesn't go through. Any best guesses here? That's what everyone's so concerned about.
You know, the Sprint has always been a little top heavy. They've always had a higher cost structure given their size, their customer base. They've done a lot of work to cut that down. A question I don't know the answer to, or maybe no one could tell me, is whether they've kind of done that now. Have they gotten lean and mean to compete on their own? That they're still cutting 500 jobs suggests maybe not.
Yeah. Frank, what's Sprint's role in the community now? I mean, it's fair to say, I assume, that it's not what it used to be, but how would you describe it today?
Well, 6,000 jobs isn't 23,000 jobs, but 6,000 jobs is still a lot of jobs. Still makes it one of the largest, private employers that we have in the region. I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
It plays a role in a variety of ways. It's been at the base of our economy. I think one of the things that's happened is we kind of got caught with an all eggs in one basket kind of economic development strategy, and what we need to do is diversify that. And I think we are working on that with the Cerner and Garmin, and the whole KC Rising effort is around improving our ability to trade with the rest of the world in a wide variety of sectors, including engineering and architecture and so on and life sciences. And so I think we're learning, but we don't have a firm yet you know, Cerner is probably the closest that sort of sits at the apex of innovation and is the economy of the future, and we can all sort of hang our hat on and have a sense of civic pride about.
What would happen to the Sprint Center, Mark Davis? Would it still be called the Sprint Center?
You know, T-Mobile has decided this new company would be T-Mobile, but they haven't said we're getting rid of the Sprint brand, and they may well want that for some segment of the market. You know, the question is whether they want to call it the T-Mobile Center at that point. It's something that the center sells, and, you know, we've seen other stadiums change their names in the sports world.
And the various charities that Sprint's involved with through its foundation, I guess we don't know yet.
I asked the CEO, Marcelo Claure, that question Monday, and he said it's too early to make any promises or commitments. But Sprint has been a very big philanthropic force in this community, a big civic leader. I mean, it's gotten involved in activities that you would think are kind of political, where they help, you know, sort of bring about the Sprint Center itself, not just put their name on it, but help bring that about. A lot of the work that they've done has been just at the employee level. And the best example of this is the CEO himself. I mean, he's a billionaire himself, but he has daughters. And one of the causes he picked up when he came here was MOXA. And he and a banker at UMB,
which is the anti-violence against women.
Yes, and so they kind of ran the fundraiser. They were the head of the fundraiser that year, and they just broke all kind of records for that thing. So they can have that kind of impact as individuals, and not just the CEO, but the other officers down the line, even the pool of 6,000 people, what they can accomplish when they get involved in these sort of things. And as that diminishes, those folks might go to other companies around town and still do that. But they could also leave for jobs elsewhere.
Are all 6,000 still based at the Sprint campus in Overland Park?
Yes, that's their employment base here. There's some employment in the stores around here, and I don't think that's in that 6,000 number.
Yeah. If our listeners want to join our conversation about the impact of what this merger involving Sprint and T-Mobile might turn out to be, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Frank, I wanted to ask you about some comments that a woman named Amy Liu made to KCUR in the wake of a previous merger possibility in 2014. She's director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Right now, she said, Kansas City certainly is at a crossroads. Almost all of its leading industries are losing market share at a time when the U.S. economy continues to expand. Does that still ring true to you?
Well, to a certain extent. You know, Casey Rising was born out of that report that we did with Brookings. And on many indicators, we are still lagging our peers. We're 12th in the creation of quality jobs.
Compared to our peer cities?
Compared to our peer cities. We compare ourselves to 30 peer metros, which is sort of the best top-line indicator that we have. You know, GDP, we're 17th. Median household income, we're 14th. So we're in the middle of the pack, but our rank has been dropping a little bit in the last couple of years. So it is clear that compared to other metros, you know, we are slipping behind, at least on some indicators.
How concerning is that?
So it is a concern, but you know, we are working really hard on things like innovation and entrepreneurship. One thing that's not well known is that you know, young firms less than 5 years old account for 2/3 of our job growth, and they added, you know, they had about 16,000 jobs a year. So that's a lot more than Sprint, and so there's a lot of jobs to be created in other sectors besides this one, and so, we're working hard in at least in a couple of those.
So, Frank, our biggest need as a metropolitan community right now would be what?
I think focus on what creates value, focus on selling things to the rest of the world, focus on where our strengths really are. And we have a lot of strengths in IT and in health IT and in architecture and engineering and in life sciences, and we just need to build on those, and we need to invest in the human capital that really makes those things go.
So, Mark Davis, the story's going to keep you busy for a while, it sounds like.
Certainly will.
Yeah, okay. That's Mark Davis. He's covered Sprint for years for the Kansas City Star. Frank Lenk, Director of Research Services for the Mid-America Regional Council. Thank you both for a good update. Sure appreciate it.
Great.
You're welcome.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Pony Express, which, of course, had its origins and spent a lot of time up in the St. Joe area. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned about proposed revisions to the Jackson County Charter. You can hear that conversation and all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, how a consent decree between the EPA, the Justice Department, and the City of Kansas City has shaped our local water rates and what the city's doing now to try and slow down rate increases. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there are a few stories that evoke the western frontier of this nation better than the Pony Express. The original Pony Express Trail, as you may know, ran from Sacramento to St. Joseph, Missouri, and it lasted a mere 18 months. Jim Felice has written the story of the Pony Express in a new book, West Like Lightning, and he begins the book with the thrilling ride that took the news of Abraham Lincoln's presidential victory in 1860 out to the West Coast. Jim DeFelice is a co-author of American Sniper and a biography of America's first five-star general, that's Omar Bradley, General at War. Jim DeFelice joins us from his home in Warwick, New York. Jim, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, Steve, thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
You know, you write, bold, rugged, and innovative, the Pony Express was of its time an almost perfect embodiment of 1860 America. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, just what I say, that, I, you know, it is absolutely America at 1860. And in a lot of ways, it's still America. I mean, think about it. It is, you know, it's about speed. It's about, you know, individuals against the elements, you know, testing yourself, getting, you know, and getting information from one place to another as quickly as possible. That's what we, you know, that's one of the big values of America today.
When you open the book and you take us through this story, it doesn't start on just any night. Why did you pick Lincoln's election to launch this story?
Well, first of all, that's a really, really important event to the country, number one. I mean, that's really a big turning point for us. And also, it's an extremely important point for, you know, for the Pony Express. A lot of the riders who, you know, in years afterwards when they were interviewed, that was the night that they remembered, because they had a sense then of moving, you know, of taking part in history even more so than just, you know, being in the service and delivering the mail. The other thing that really that was interesting to me in doing the book and why I wanted to do the book is the Pony Express happens at a time of a lot of change and important innovation in our country. And I wanted to use the Pony Express as a way of talking about America in 1860 and 1861. And it was kind of the perfect vehicle for that.
The riders, these frontier kids, as you called them, spent a lot of time waiting and waiting until they finally set off and so swiftly with the mail. Can you describe what a ride was like for these guys?
Well, you know, we're talking about 1,900 miles. So, you know, and each individual rider might, you know, cover maybe 100 miles of that. So we have to make a little bit of generalizations. But, you know, in the area, say, of, you know, as they ride through Kansas, it's pretty, it's mostly level. And you're, and even though Missouri really is on the frontier at that time, it's fairly settled, and you know, you're just going for speed, and the rides are relatively uneventful for the most part. Now you get out towards Utah, you get out in the desert, and you know, or even in the mountains, and you're talking about heat, you're talking about ridiculous cold. In the winter, when you're in the Sierras, you're talking about snow that might be 30 feet high. So a lot of hardship out there.
And when you talk about kids, you really do mean kids. How old were these young men who rode for the Pony Express?
Well, you know, you know, certainly to, well, I guess to me, maybe I'm revealing my age. Everybody's a kid these days.
I know, but the feeling, Jim. Yeah.
And there's more of them every year. I don't understand. But the typical rider would be, say, 19 to 21. And they're always he, by the way, as far as we know. They'd be in very good physical shape. And they'd generally be from the area. I mean, there are a few exceptions that may have, you know, come west into some of the desert areas. But for the most part, they knew the terrain very well. They'd been riding, you know, pretty much since birth in most cases. And they pretty much would divide into two camps. One would last, you know, a couple of weeks, and then they'd be gone. And the others would, you know, would ride on for, you know, basically for 18 or months, as long as the service lasted. Pretty much your typical farm, tough, independent farm boys, a lot like farm kids these days.
Yeah. We're visiting with Jim DeFelice, the author of a new book, West Like Lightning, that'll be out in a few days. It's about the history of the Pony Express. And these riders became superstars, right? I mean, of all the riders, who do you think has loomed the largest in America's imagination?
Well, I'll tell you, the guy that loomed the largest and really did the most for the Pony Express probably didn't actually ride for the Pony Express, although he said he did and everybody thinks he did. And that's Buffalo Bill Cody.
Mm-hmm.
Cody certainly worked for the companies that were associated with the Pony Express. It's actually a cluster of companies that the owners owned and were connected with the Pony Express. He may, and I mean may, have ridden, you know, once or twice as a substitute, but he was very young at the time the Pony Express was operating. However, years later, Bill Cody becomes famous for these Wild West shows, which really, when they traveled all through the West, through Missouri, through Kansas, through, you know, and back east to Chicago, New York City, overseas, London. And when they came into your town, it was like the Super Bowl moving in. I mean, it was just massive. People, everybody came out to see it. And, you know, for 3 days or however long they were there, everybody in the, not only the county, but the surrounding counties would come in. And every show, or just about every show, Cody would start and end with a display of the Pony Express. So he made the Pony Express absolutely famous in small towns, big towns, and everything in between all across America and the world.
So how long then did it take to get a letter from the middle of America, say St. Joe, out to California?
Obviously, it would depend on which exact run we have, and there's been some remarkable work by stamp collectors, actually, who figured out exactly how long each route took. But generalizing, it would take roughly 10 days to get from St. Joe to Sacramento. And from Sacramento, the letter could then go down by steamer to San Francisco in a few hours. If you wanted to get a letter, say, from New York City out to St. Joe, add maybe 3 days in there, depending on the train schedules and when you posted the letter. The way west, as a general rule, would take at least another day or 2 days. Some of that would be due to some bad luck, you know, just with, you know, when the weather was or whatever, or maybe a problem with the exchange. And others just had to do with the, you know, with the geography and just other variables. It would always take a little longer.
In today's dollars, what would it cost to send just a basic, ordinary letter?
In today's dollars, you couldn't really afford it. That's actually not true. What I should say is, in today's dollars, it would cost a couple of bucks. To the Pony Express service, basically they were losing about $1,000 a ride.
Why did they lose money?
Well, it was always designed. It was designed really as kind of a promotion to help to prove to the government that these companies that owned the Pony Express should get $1 million mail contract. And so they, you know, they started it, and it was as much a big PR stunt as anything else. It captured the imagination of the nation, and certainly all the people that lived from California to St. Joe's and in between, they were all for it. A lot of the people back east were for it because they needed to have a strong connection with California, knowing that the Civil War was coming on. Unfortunately, and some things never change, when you depend on the government, they don't always come through, certainly not in time. They do eventually get that contract, But unfortunately, when they get it, it comes months late, and it's worth about half of what they were promised.
Akers from Kansas City, Missouri wants to know if there were any African-American Pony Express riders.
That's a great question. As far as we know, no. And when I say as far as we know, we can't be definitively sure who was riding, who all of the riders were. There's been a lot of work by historians and museums, local museums, in pulling together some information on who the actual riders were. What happens is after the pony is over, obviously everyone disperses. You have the Civil War, records are lost, but then you have kind of the rebirth of the legend, we'll call it, when the Wild West show goes on, and then everybody wants to be a pony rider. So you have all of these false stories they turn out when people go and look. But all of the people that have looked very carefully have not been able to find anyone who was, who was African-American. Right. There's a couple of riders, or possible riders, who were probably Native Americans or partly Native Americans. We also haven't found any women.
We're talking about the history of the Pony Express with Jim DeFelice, his new book, West Like Lightning. Tell us about the handoffs, you know, when one rider would ride into a station and pass the mail on to the next rider. What would happen?
Well, you have two kinds of stations, two kinds of relays. The first relay would take place, let's say, roughly 10 miles after you've started. And there you just swap the horse. And you had a special combination blanket and mail pouch that you would grab off of the saddle, hop onto the other horse, throw that onto the saddle, and then take off. Ride another 10 miles, another exchange. At each exchange, there's usually a stable boy or, most often a young man who's holding the other horse. And these things happen, these things happen in a flash within seconds. Hmm. And, at night in wild weather or not. Then
so it wasn't like the riders would stop and get a cup of coffee and ask about the weather. It was generally speaking, a quick handoff.
Oh, absolutely. It was like, 10 seconds would be a long stop. You could get the coffee at the station house, which would happen every, 100 miles or so, just roughly. And there another rider would be waiting impatiently on his horse, well, actually not on his horse, but ready to jump on his horse as soon as he got the mail bag from you, and he'd run off.
You almost picture this notion, this romantic idea of sitting out in the middle of Kansas and in the middle of the night and listening for the horse to come and listening for the steps of the horse in the dirt and wondering what that moment might have been like.
You know, it's fantastically romantic.
Yeah, very much so.
And standing, there when I was out, especially in Kansas, and just admiring just the vast stretches of scenery and and farms and things growing. It's very romantic. The reality, though, was probably a little less romantic when it was raining and maybe, in Kansas winters can be a little cold. And so maybe the romance is something that we supply a little bit of.
Our phone number, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Kevin from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi there. Good morning.
Hi, Kevin.
Good morning. Thanks so much. Fascinating stuff, period, as part of Americana, let alone local history. But we always see those pictures of these, young, wiry guys who got on these horses and then, give full gallop for however long, and then they had that handoff you were talking about. Is this realistic for those of us who have ridden or who occasionally ride horses? Did they go at full gallop? Would it have been full gallop for 10 miles? Or what's a rough description of it? Is that remotely accurate at all, or is it romantic dribble?
Full gallop or not? What do you say,
yeah,
Jim?
Yeah, not full. Rarely Well, I can think of a few instances where you absolutely would go at full gallop. That's when you're being chased by someone. But that actually didn't happen all that often. I would say that, you know, the typical pace would be, you know, kind of a smart, a little bit more than a walk. I mean, they're not wandering. They know the horse probably knows the trail better than they do in some instances. But full gallop is just very, you know, as the caller is saying, you know, that's just unrealistic. So most of the time, it's just kind of a good trotting pace.
Hmm. Hope that helps, Kevin.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you. You know, I'm wondering why St. Joe was the starting point for this thing, Jim.
Well, you know, I wondered that too, because I'm thinking, when you look at it, you say, well, why not start on the other side of the river, right? Mm-hmm. You know, why not start on the other side of the Missouri? Well, come to find out, what happened was the guys that started the Pony Express, William Russell, Alexander Majors, and William Waddell, they're actually kind of wily businessmen. What they did is they had actually had their business, which was a transportation, combined transportation, finance, wholesale goods, even small markets. They had actually had a lot of that already on both sides of the Missouri, around Kansas City, Lexington, on the other, all on both sides of the river. What they did is they bid each of the communities against each other, a lot like sports teams do now when they're, bidding for sports stadiums. And St. Joe's gave them the best deal. They gave them space near a future train station. They gave them some free, whole bunch of free land that Russell, Majors, and Waddell would have sold for a profit, and they gave them a bunch of other, financial concessions and rights to use the railroad. So, these guys were very, very savvy when they were arranging to find where their headquarters would be.
Did they have a feeling at the time that this Pony Express thing was only going to last 18 months, Jim? I mean, that's not a long-term business. Did they have a feeling this was just filling a gap in a certain window in American history?
Well, yes, absolutely. It was designed as a limited venture. I don't know about 18 months. I think that's probably a lot shorter than they thought. But what they were trying to do was to establish a transportation, freight, financial monopoly out west. Now, another company had done that a little bit earlier, also around the frontier. The frontier happens to be the frontier involving upper New York State and then some of the close Midwest and around the Erie Canal. That company still exists. It's called American Express.
Huh. Wow.
And the model for America and the model that Russell, Waddell, and Majors kind of follow is very, very similar. As a matter of fact, their main competitor in this whole venture was a company that's also still around, and it was started by two of the three guys that were the principals of American Express, and we know it today as Wells Fargo.
Wow.
So
wow.
It wasn't, they were actually onto something. They just bit off a little bit more than they could chew.
You know, Alexander Majors is a name that's still pretty well known around these parts. His house is out around, 80th and Warnell or, somewhere in that neighborhood. Did he really show up at Post to check on the writers and make all of his employees take this oath?
Majors is a character right out of the pages of American history. I mean, he is a real frontiersman. If he had been born maybe 10 years earlier, he would have been discovering, South Pass. He would have all sorts of things. But he was really kind of the hands-on guy of the owners. And yes, he did. He showed up all over the place. A lot of their business was driving, ox carts from one place, from Leavenworth to, different Ford or from here to there. He would show up, and he did. He had a whole list of requirements that everyone in the company was supposed to keep. Now, I and he also would give them a Bible to swear on that they would do. I have to confess, I don't know that there was 100% compliance with all of his requirements,
right,
especially since one was that they wouldn't drink or swear, and I don't know. I think there was a little leeway when he wasn't around, but yes, that's absolutely true.
You know, how much of this route did you travel yourself, and did you actually hop on a horse and give it a whirl, or how close did you come to actually first-personing this thing?
I traveled the whole route, primarily by car, but I walked in a lot of cases. There's no truth to the rumor that there were a few places where I had to trespass on private property. I totally deny that. I got lost. I have to confess, I did get lost once somewhere between Nevada and Utah, which had, if I knew exactly where it was, I guess I wouldn't have been lost. But you know, the funny thing is, you know, when you're lost today, you know, no cell phone, no GPS, a car is somewhere over there somewhere, but you just know that if you keep going, at some point, you know, you're going to come to a road, you're going to come to civilization.
And the riders themselves avoided getting lost because what, they were on a trail? Is that what explains, but it's the middle of the night? I mean, how many of them would get lost?
A few of them got lost, and that, you know, was the big thing for me. I mean, for me, you know, I'm never really in any danger, and these guys were in danger every day. There's a few stories about them being lost, actually, ironically, out there in the desert, where at night, if it's dark, there's no features. One instance, the horse actually kind of nudged, supposedly, nudged the rider, you know, back towards the main trail.
Wow. That's Jim DeFelice, his story, The Pony Express. West Like Lightning comes out next week. Jim, it's a great story. Thanks for sharing it with us. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it myself.
All the best. On yesterday's show, we learned about frugal science and met the inventor developing cheap solutions to big problems like the $1 microscope. You can hear that conversation along with our previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCURUpToDate. Follow me at Steve Kraske and follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, the ethics professors are back. We'll pick their brains about the NRA and ask if people receiving food assistance from the government should be able to use it to buy unhealthy food. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.